Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your host, Doug and Amy.
Welcome to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. We've got some pretty cool stuff. We are Ready Radio, and Doug, basically, we're ready for anything. We talk about emergency preparedness.
From the small scale to the large.
Yes, yes. And today we're going to talk about sort of a large scale emergency, such as maybe a financial collapse or, an EMP, sort of where, there's no electricity and nothing's running as it normally does. And we're going to look at sort of the legal ramifications of disasters today.
And I know this is kind of playing to my strengths today, and I appreciate you bringing the topic up. We had talked before about the physical effects of the EMP and the financial effects of a real crisis, something like the loss of reserve currency status. And all of these things are things that are going to impact people in a variety of ways. The EMP comes and you no longer have electricity. So you're trying to figure out how to either repair electrical lines, you're trying to figure out how to generate electricity, you're trying to figure out how to do things mechanically instead. We're talking about going back to bicycles instead of cars or horse and carriage, whatever needs to be done to be able to get through. But there are legal ramifications to all of this too. And there are, as we go into a survival situation where people are acting in self-defense, at the time you may be in a situation where you have a shooting and there's no one to investigate it and who knows what's going to happen, but eventually there is always justice and peace restored, and then there are consequences for all those actions. So there's a lot of different avenues where the law may not be there at the moment, but it's coming back.
Yeah, and this is something, and of course, today's show was my idea, and primarily because there are a lot of different areas legally that I'm unaware of, and I know that you just have a plethora of information, and so I'm hoping to be your student today and learn from you. And Doug, one of the first things that I had sort of occurred to me was if we had something such as like a financial collapse, and we, maybe I didn't have income coming in, maybe it was so big that there were no more mortgage companies, but I'm staying in my home. I don't have money to pay a mortgage company. Maybe they don't exist. I'm interested to know what that would look like, if there are ways that I would be evicted. I want to know about squatters' rights and things along those lines.
Well, this is very state-specific. Most of the eviction laws have to do with states' rights. Now, there's kind of like there's a federal minimum bar they have to meet, but all the state laws are at least to that bar or greater as far as your rights go. So if you're listening in Alaska or North Dakota or Arizona, you're going to have different answers on what eviction means than you would here in Georgia. Now, I'm licensed in Georgia. I'm also licensed in Alaska. I've practiced in both states actively. I've been a practicing attorney for over a decade now. I graduated from Emory University, and in my class, it was a wonderful institution. I learned a lot. I've practiced both criminal and civil, mainly criminal, but both fields of law I've dabbled in over the years. So I have a varied background and a lot of expertise in this matter. But most of the biggest problem when you get to a financial collapse, it's not usually instant. You're not going to see everything go away overnight. Mm-hmm. That's not an EMP.
Right.
So you're going to watch a slow and steady decline over a period of time. And the best example of this is the Great Depression. The Great Depression did not happen in April of 29 when the stock market crashed. Mm-hmm. It really started happening in 1930 and 31. And by 33, it was really bad. And by 34, it was terrible. Mm-hmm. And so you saw a three-year decline into this abyss. And all the time, what's happening is that companies that are less solvent are folding. Their assets are being bought up by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Their depositors are being moved around to other institutions. Their mortgages are being taken in as collateral for bad payments, the banks that fold, and they're being sold to banks that can support them. And so you're not really left in a moment where you say, okay, I'm going to mail my check in and there's nobody to take it. Woo-hoo, I've got a windfall. I don't have to pay mortgage this month. So there's always somebody who's going to get it. And in the lender of last resort, my theory is if it really got so bad that all of the banks, and I mean all of the banks were collapsing globally, the governments would step in and they would say,
of course they would.
They would say, all of these mortgages are now ours. Pay the money to us because they're not going to disappear because there's nothing that they can become insolvent on. I mean, they spend the money no matter what, right?
Right.
So I don't think that there would ever be a point where you would be able to say, I have no mortgage holder. But it does get really tricky. I have a friend of mine who was buying a house, and his house, the note, had gone through, I think, five different mortgage companies that had folded. Each one.
Oh, my goodness.
It was transferred to this one, and it folded, and transferred to that one, and it folded. And by the end, you had a title mess trying to figure out where was it in default, who owed the money to whom, when was it going to get paid, and trying to buy this house out of foreclosure. I mean, where does the money go? So it can get very tricky very quickly as the collapse expands. Now, this comes up to, well, what happens to people who are not paying their mortgage? You know, where the first instance, you've got people who are able to pay and willing to pay, and they cannot figure out who to pay. That's one subset of debtors. But then we have the more classical set where you have people who just no longer can afford to pay because of the collapse. They've lost their jobs. They've been downsized. Their family went from making $120 a year to making $38 a year. And there's no way that you can feed your family and pay the mortgage. And so you make a hard choice and you choose to stop paying the mortgage. Well, what happens? In Georgia, you're required to give 60 days notice on an eviction. And then you have to get out because you're not paying your mortgage. But after that, once you get a writ from a court after 60 days is up, you have to be out in 10 days. It's statutory. There's nothing a judge can do about it. It's not your fault. It's not their fault. It's nobody's fault. If the judge would, he would give you more time, but he can't, and there's nothing that can be done about it. You're out in 10 days. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so I'm a bank. I've got someone who's not paying the mortgage. I get them out. I can then go and sell the house, but I can't make money on it. I have to sell it for what I'm owed, nothing more.
Oh, okay.
So there's no advantage to the bank. They just want their money up and down. They don't really care. And you being in the house paying the mortgage is much more advantageous to them than nobody being in the house and not getting paid at all.
Right.
So a lot of times the property is put up for auction. And when you have a thriving, you know, industry, you've got good real estate market, the market's not flooded, you've got investors who have capital who no longer trust the stock market, let's say, because the stock market wasn't doing well, then they turn to real estate because no one's making any more of it. You know, you've heard that phrase.
Right.
So in that sort of an environment, the house sells quickly at auction for the amount that's owed, the bank gets paid off, any extra goes to the mortgage holder. And they're out on the street, but the bank is paid off and there's somebody utilizing the house. And that's the entire point of this area of law, is you want utilization of the property. Because if it's sitting empty, it's no good to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a key point. Because as we saw in 2008 and 2009, when we had the last housing market bubble burst on top of a recession, a lot of these houses were going to be absolutely vacant. Why? Because nobody was investing in real estate.
Yep.
You'd seen house prices, you know, go from $250,000 down to $80,000.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody was willing to put money into a market that was shrinking. And then we had a surplus of houses. I remember someone saying, at the rate we're going, you know, we're going to have not need any new house construction for 10 years because of the way, you know, everyone's going back to apartments and the vacancies. You know, when you get to that kind of level, what do you do? You know, there's all these empty buildings. If a house isn't lived in, it rots. Have you ever been in a house that's been vacant for a long time?
I have, yeah, yeah. There, many, many years ago, we were kind of looking around at properties, investment properties and that kind of thing. And, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, you walk through the yard and you've got grass up to your thigh and, you know, you're afraid of, you're going to have, like, little snakes
and,
and spiders. And
but even aside from the lawn maintenance, when you get into a house that's been empty for 6 months, you can smell it. You know,
yes.
It has that feeling that nobody has been here. And there's the way you keep a house alive is you have to have people in it. So what do you do when you know you're not going to be able to sell it? you know, the market's not there to sell it to get your money back out of it. You can't sit on it and make a profit. If you sit on it, say, let's let it ride for like 5 years, and then the market will rebound and we'll sell it for a profit, the extra money goes to the mortgage holder mm-hmm. again. So you're stuck as the bank. You have no interest in holding on to this
thing. Right.
So the best thing you can do is to keep it occupied. And the banks were cutting deals with people left and right, saying, well, we'll give you a very low rental. You're kicked out. You're gone. You're, you know, sayonara mm-hmm. on ever owning this
No longer
thing.
The owner, yes.
But we would be willing to rent it to you at a very reduced rate. You keep it up. You do the rental thing. And they were hiring rental property mm-hmm. managers to do
yeah,
this.
I remember when they started that, yeah.
Yep, all yeah. over the city. And that was a good solution. Now, in the future, if there's a bigger economic collapse or there's a housing market collapse like that again, I envision that sort of things happening a lot more than some kind of new legal fix it mm-hmm. because the free market can work a solution way better than government ever can. And this is something, this is a little bit of free advice for everyone who's listening, who might be getting into a situation where they're looking at foreclosure or eviction. When you're at the hearing, when you're at the final hearing, you're putting all of your cards, all of your chips, everything up to someone who knows nothing about you, who knows nothing about your situation, who's going to listen to you for maybe 5 or 10 minutes and make a decision that you couldn't make. And is that really the situation you want to be in, where you let a judge do that? Everyone hopes that the judges are going to be able to wave this magic legal wand and pull something out of their hat where everybody is happy. Well, the truth is that when a judge makes a decision, nobody is happy mm-hmm. at all.
Right.
And that's kind of the point of it. You couldn't come up with a decision where you were happy, so someone makes the hard call and makes everybody unhappy. I know we're coming up on a commercial break, so stick with us, folks. We'll be right back in a few minutes. You're listening to News Talk 1160, the Talk of the Town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us. We are going to jump right back in. And when we left, we were talking about foreclosures, and we left off in a bad spot where we basically were in courts and we turned everything over to the judges. But Doug, I think what would be great to look at is maybe not getting to that point, because I have a feeling that when people, you know, either they don't have the means to pay their mortgage or they give up, they're silent. And, you know, they're silent and they just hope for the best. So what can they do before they get to the part where the judges make the decisions?
And this is a good point, because people, the reason they're silent is that they have this belief in our system of justice that the judge is going to do something and make it all right. And that's not what the system's made for. It really isn't. The civil system is designed to make choices for you that you couldn't make. And usually it comes down on the side of what's written in your contract. Mm-hmm. And if you right. haven't paid it, if you can't do it, then that's that. Now, there are contracts and there are leases and there are things fall into realms where the judge will say, no, you can't do that. I mean, you can't make a contract to kill somebody. You know, no matter how you word it, it's called unconscionable. You can't do that. And there, you can't have a lease where everything is slated for the landlord and the tenant is always losing. No matter what they do, the tenant loses. That's you know, called an unconscionable or unenforceable contract. And then you have contracts that you make that are called contracts of adhesion, where people who are coming into the contract, they say, you know, I want to change this provision or I want to do this differently, and the contract writer, whoever wrote the contract and who's trying to get them to sign, says, nope, it is completely take it or leave it. If you don't like it, walk away. Mm-hmm. And those are called contracts of adhesion. In different states, they're treated differently. In Georgia, contracts of adhesion are enforceable, but they're strictly construed against the author of the document. So if you didn't dot your I's and cross your T's on a contract of adhesion, you're done. Mm. The whole thing is just going to be tossed out because it's strictly construed against you. Mm. It's not going to be given any latitude or leniency. So there's lots of legal ways to wrangle on a landlord-tenant issue. But what's so much better, what's a way better solution, is to, instead of trying to hire an attorney and fight this out and go to court and go in front of a judge and roll the dice, and let me tell you, 10 years of experience, hundreds of jury trials, thousands of cases, okay? Mm-hmm. I know what I'm talking about mm-hmm. here. Every time you go in front of a judge or a jury, we call them triers of fact, when mm-hmm. you're at a point where they're going to figure out what the facts are, you are rolling the dice, taking a chance, and you do not know what's going to happen. Everything is a gamble at that mm-hmm. point. Now, sane people don't go into a situation where you're taking incredible amounts of money and rolling them on a pitch of the dice. You just don't do that.
Right.
So no matter how bad off you are, no matter what your situation is in dealing with a landlord, you always have a little bit to put on the table in this game. Because if you can settle it out of court, then you don't have the uncertainty of what the judge is going to do. You don't have the expenses of an attorney. And as a landlord, it costs money. Now, some of the big companies have people on retainer who do this all the time, and they're paid a flat fee, and it doesn't cost them anything extra. But if the attorney's spending time on this project, they're not spending it on the next project.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a trade-off there. So you've got an investment of money, you've got an investment of time, and you've got an uncertainty factor. And all three of these things pull together to make it much more advantageous for both parties to come together, figure out a private settlement, something that works for everybody, and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, then nobody loses. You can get a situation where everyone walks away with just a little bit disgruntledness, but nobody is really hurting,
mm-hmm.
instead of having the cleaver come down and maybe cut off both of your hands.
Right.
So this is a way that you can take control of your own destiny and not throw it up to government caprice. I mean, we talk all the time about being self-sufficient and being independent and doing things for yourself. Well, the legal world is not independent of that. Being able to grow tomatoes is fantastic. Being able to build your own AR-15 is wonderful. But if you're not willing to take charge of your legal situations and your legal problems and try to make an effort to fix them, then you're just as helpless as the person who refuses to have any food in their house and thinks that, you know, the water fairy will always be there.
So, Doug, when is it that someone should approach, like, their mortgage holder? Like, let's say that, you know, they give you a little bit of grace and maybe there's a certain amount of time. I mean,
the more you talk to them, the better off you will be.
So you don't want to wait that whole 60 days until they're about to serve you paper stamp.
No, you should be talking to them. If you are in a position where you're, you know, not going to have the funds to pay your mortgage, you should be talking to them proactively and saying, look, I need to renegotiate. I need to do something. And here's what's going to happen. Because if we go down this road, you're going to end up trying to evict me. Now, in an economy that's booming and you're the only one in 40 miles that is in this situation, you may not have much bargaining power.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're one of hundreds, if there's some kind of a collapse and there are hundreds of places going down, the people who talk to them first to take that problem off their caseload are going to be the ones that get the best deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe you say, hey, I'm not good at this. I don't know what I'm doing. I can't talk to people. I'm not used to that. Get an attorney. You don't need an attorney who's going to be saying, let's take it to court. You need an attorney who's saying, let's figure out the best way to negotiate this. Maybe we can do it in just a couple of hours of work. And it'll save you so much over the course of it that, you know, that $200-$400 investment is well worth it if you feel that you're not capable. But there's no reason that you can't take a stab at it yourself. You know, the independent spirit is very important here.
Yeah, so in the economy, so that's kind of, I guess, the big picture that I kind of focus on is, you know, being into emergency preparedness. And, you know, I kind of have that view of if the economy is tanking, no matter what the I guess, root cause
impetus.
Is. Yeah. Yeah, sort of from that standpoint. And I'm saying everything just tanking. Do you have any advice, I guess, as far as, I mean, if we didn't have that extra money, it's either the money, you know, for an attorney, either we feed our family or we pay for an attorney. What would be some good points or talking points to the mortgage companies?
Well, first off, you need to explain the situation. You know, is there hope that you're going to be able to make payments in the future? Is there a level that you could pay rent on the property? You need to come up with a proactive plan and propose it. You can't just go to them and say, I don't have any money anymore. What do you want me to do? Because their answer is going to be, get out.
Right.
But if you come and you say, look, we've had an 80% loss of income here. I need X amount to be able to feed my family, and this is a reasonable amount to feed my family. I have this left over. I'm willing to make this payment. Can we work on this? And in a few months, we're hoping that this will pan out, or we'll be able to do this or that, and then we'll have more income and be able to step it up again. And that sort of proactive, thought-out, reasoned plan has a lot of sway. Just saying, I don't know, what do you want me to do? Which I think a lot of people end up doing. A lot of people, when they come to my office, do that. They're like, I'm in this situation and I don't know what to do. You figure it out for me. And as an attorney, I'm happy to get paid to figure out how to solve the problems that you've worked yourself into. But if you can make that proactive decision to have a plan, and this goes back to every single aspect of emergency preparedness, you have to start with a plan. You can't just go and buy random junk and say, I'm prepared. You can't just say, well, when it happens, I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Until you have the plan in place that underpins everything, you haven't prepared at all. And these sorts of things, you know, having a job loss or an economic collapse or not being able to pay your bills or facing an eviction, is something you should have a plan for. It can't just be, well, it will never happen to me, because that's the same attitude you take towards a tornado or a hurricane, and then when it hits, you're unprepared. So focus on having a plan of something that you can do. And the biggest thing you can do is to start to reason out, you need to save some money now, you need to put up and prepare, but when push comes to shove, look, be able to evaluate your situation, come up with a plan that's reasonable, and then do your very best to pitch it to them. And if you have a reasonable plan that doesn't put them in a worse financial position, their odds are they'll take it rather than to go through the stress and fight of trying to get more out of you that you can't get. There's a point where you cannot get blood out of a turnip.
Yeah, and I love your idea of saving money. I'm a big Dave Ramsey fan, and can I say that on this radio show?
I'm sure you can.
I love him. I did his Financial Peace University, and one of the things he absolutely harps on is getting out of debt, mm-hmm. and saving money, and just having that, your emergency fund, exactly. And he has like a certain amount of time, and then, you know, after your credits, you know, all paid up, and then kind of really putting in a lot, you know, all that extra money, and you know, kind of going into like a, I mean, we're looking at severe, you know, when you and I talk, I know a lot of times we sort of look at what could happen on the severe side. Mm-hmm. So if we are looking at, you know, a severe financial collapse or something along those sides, it's going to help, you know, we think possibly having that extra money if you're able to, first of all, access it. If, you know, the banks aren't all, you know, collapsing and closing and shutting their doors.
Well, when I say money, I don't mean Federal Reserve note, greenback currency per se. I mean things that have cash value that are liquid. You know, your 64 Mustang convertible may have incredible cash value now, but after a collapse it may not. Mm-hmm. So
right.
While it may be valuable, it doesn't have the liquidity that you may need to change out. Gold is always liquid, mm-hmm. but the exchange rate on gold is going to fluctuate based on the commodities that are in the area. So I mean, you know, your jasmine or your saffron may be astronomical because it's not available here, whereas rice may be, or corn in North Georgia may be incredibly cheap, and so you could get a lot of it for very little. The other problem with gold is that it is such incredibly valuable per ounce that it's very hard to make small purchases with it. So then mm-hmm. you get into other metals. There are people who, you know, silver is obviously a go-to. It's much cheaper. You can have a silver coin that purchases a relatively small amount of things instead of having to, you know, divide up, you know, tenths of a gram of gold to try to purchase something. But people are even now minting commemorative coins, not real coins, because that power is solely vested in Congress, but minting commemorative coins out of copper, because copper has a certain value, but it's a very low value. So, and you know, this seems like a really new idea to make coins out of real money, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a little bit about fiat currency when we come back, folks. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Doug and Amy. When we left, we were talking about fiat currency, which I promise you is not the money you get back when you trade in your fiat 500.
No.
But instead, we're talking about money that is backed instead of by metal or something that has physical value, but money that's backed by the economy of the country that prints it. So here in the U.S., we're the world's leading economy. We produce trillions of dollars worth of goods and services a year, and we print money based on the value of what we can do as a country. It's kind of like printing money on credit.
Is that what it's based on? Because I'm always so confused. Seems like they just print it without... I mean, we just need some more money. Let's just run more.
Well,
go print some more.
There's quantitative easing in there, and yes, it has gotten a little bit away from the idea. But the basic principle of fiat currency is that it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, and that
sure.
comes from the ability of us as a country to produce things and to create things, and we have value, and we create value out of nothing. Therefore, we can create money that's
sure.
based on that value.
I like it. Let's call it that.
But back in the day, you used to actually take a piece of metal that was worth a dollar, stamp a dollar on it, and hand it around. And if you, you know, didn't like it that it was set a dollar, you could melt it down and turn it back into the metal, and then you could go trade it for a dollar because mm-hmm. it was worth a dollar. And the money stayed connected. We were on the gold standard for years, and $20 was worth an ounce of gold. Now an ounce of gold is worth, what, $1,400. Mm. But for years and years and years, we locked it in, and it stayed where it was. And so people are going back to having real money. When it's made out of metal, that's worth real money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't really stamp a dollar on it, because then you'd be running in the face of the federal guidelines on right. who can print currency. But you make a silver disc out of silver, and you weigh it, and you stamp on it 99.999 pure, and you know what it's worth, because you can just weigh it, and you know what it's worth. And no matter how the dollar fluctuates, you know what it's worth. Mm-hmm. There are commodities. Anything that is a real commodity has liquidity so that you can trade it off for things that you need. I don't care if it's rice. I don't care if it's gold. I don't care if it's ammunition. I don't care if it's a gun. You know, there are some guns that have collector's value and have value because of that. But all these things are things that are easily sold and bought and traded and are liquid. And that's the whole point. So when I say you need to have savings, your savings does not have to be $50,000 in a bank account mm-hmm. with Wells Fargo that you can go and, you know, pull up the receipt for.
Right.
It can be canned goods. In a real emergency, the canned goods are going to go a long way. Let's say that you spend $1,000 a month on your mortgage and $1,000 a month on food. Now, if you get your budget cut in half, you have to make a choice. Do you spend the $1,000 you have left coming in, do you spend it on the mortgage or on food? Well, what if you have 6 months worth of food saved up? You spend it on the mortgage, right. you eat the food, and you've effectively paid your mortgage with food.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's a good point.
I mean, that's the goal, is that we keep enough, not just cash. And you do need cash. I mean, there are some times when you go to get, you know, your brakes done, and the guy just won't take a sheep.
Sometimes.
No matter how many times I ask them at Meineke to take a sheep, they just won't do it. So there are times you need cash, but there are times when you can free up your cash by having other resources. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the goals here. You were asking me about what, you know, kind of the bigger implications and what happens when you have this kind of super collapse and what does it mean for law. But the problem is that we're going to start to go away from civil law at that point. We're going to get more and more into criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
There are, in any time of economic disruption, whether it's going to be from an EMP and a physical attack or an economic collapse or anything, as wages goes down, crime goes up.
Mm, oh, yes.
And you're going to see that repeated throughout history. Now, what happens there? Well, is the state government and the city government financially solvent enough to employ enough police officers to keep up with the rising rates? Are they going to have enough facilities in the local jails to be able to house people who are arrested for minor crimes? Probably not. We can't even do that now.
Mm-mm.
And part of the problem is that we spend so much of our time chasing down things which are societal crimes instead of personal crimes. I think that we need to focus more on crimes that you can point to a victim. I once saw a flow chart where it said, if you know, is there a victim? And they went down to yes or no. And if it's no, then is there a crime? And if it said yes, the next point was, is the victim society? And if the answer was yes, then go back to there is no victim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe a little flippant. There are some crimes that are societal crimes, but the idea being is when there's a big collapse, they're not going to be worried so much about someone who is not wearing their seatbelt.
Right, exactly.
They're not going to worry about someone who's smoking pot. They're going to be worrying about the rapes and the murders mm-hmm. and the real victim crimes. And then you get to, well, what about shoplifting?
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a victim crime. It does hurt the store owner, and it hurts all of us as a society because it can have increased costs, but is it worth the manpower of assigning a police detective to chase somebody down? And if you do catch a shoplifter who stole, I don't know, a $50 thing out of a store, are you going to lock him up in a jail and tie up a jailer and tie up that cell and all of the, you know, expenses in a flourishing economy? Sure. We do that because it keeps the overall crime rate down, and it's worth it. In a society that's collapsing, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things, too, that I can kind of imagine is, you know, police officers are, you know, they're people, too. And just a big shout out to our police officers out there. But, you know, a lot of them have families and, you know, wives and kids. Or if they are the women, you know, husbands. And you know, they're great people. And we love them. But here's the thing, Doug. I mean, I can kind of see if things are falling apart around you, I can kind of see them saying, "Oop, going to go protect my family." And they take their things and they head out and they're, you know, their main focus is their family.
Absolutely. And there's a point when things are at their darkest when they will run off. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody would. You just don't show up for work on days when the snow is falling to a certain degree. You say, you know, I just can't make it in. And and people who are in law enforcement and public service, and I think that law enforcement is a lot broader than just people who have arrest powers. I think there's lots of people who enforce the law in their own ways and contribute to the stability of the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point where you just say, I cannot do this. But I think that, again, like the Great Depression, most of this is not going to be this instant huge collapse where mm-hmm. there's rioting in the streets and who knows what's going to happen. And if there are, those incidents are going to be smaller and self-contained, like the riots in L.A. following the Rodney King incident, mm-hmm. things like that, where it's a localized event. You're not going to see that nationwide. So instead, you're going to have this like continuing increase in crime and a decrease in the ability to pay for it, and then there's going to be focusing on certain types of crimes. In the riot situation, when the whole blocks are burning and they're looting, and what do? You're in a self-defense situation. You may have to shoot somebody. What are the consequences of that? How do we as a society deal with that in the aftermath? We've had some of these situations here in the U.S. before, but they've been so small and so minor and so few deaths that we haven't had to come nationally to terms with it. But you can look around the world and see places where that has happened. Look at Rwanda. Look at, you know, mm-hmm. the Ivory Coast. Look at a lot of places in Africa where they've had genocide and war crimes. And what they are calling war crimes was what I would call a massive riot of sustained duration. And you've got people who... I read a story in the Washington Post not long ago about a woman and a gentleman, and I use the term loosely, who were working to resolve war crimes problems in Africa. And they had been involved years before in an incident where he had killed her baby daughter and cut off one of her hands.
Oh, my.
And now they were working together to try to bring reconciliation to the warring communities there. And you think, you know, I personally, if someone had cut off my hand and killed one of my children, there would be no way that I would ever work with them. There, I'd probably spend the rest of my life hunting them down. Mm-hmm. But that's, and there becomes a point where, what do? You know, and the society is broken down, laws are thrown out the windows, everyone's for themselves. Then there's a period of calm, normalcy is restored, and something has to be done to have national healing about that incident. And we've never had that kind of in our lifetimes, anything like that. The biggest thing that we've had was the Civil War. And, you know, that is, what, 7 generations removed now? There is not a living person who can say anything about it.
Right.
And yet, tensions run high talking about it. This is, what, 150 years ago? And tensions still bubble about it?
Yeah, they do.
Wait till there's something that is not... We left the Union and we had an army and our army fought your army. That gives you at least some stability and some gravitas to it. What if it's just this gang of street thugs came and beat my family and killed my wife? Or those people came into my town and looted the store and killed the store owner who'd been there for 70 years? When it's those kinds of things, when there's no formality, there's no, you know, sense of national community on one side and the other, when it's just looting and rape gangs, how do you bring people together? How do you get reconciliation? How do you get forgiveness? How do you get, well, the way you do that is through a judicial process. That's why we have courts. We have courts to keep people from going and killing other people when they were done wrong, because that's what we would debase to. That's what human nature is when you hurt my family, I'll go hurt your family. And it escalates. Every time it escalates, you hurt my son, I kill your wife, you kill my whole family. And it goes back and forth, and Hatfields and McCoys. And the reason we have courts now is to prevent that sort of escalation from happening. Folks, you're listening to News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town. We'll be right back talking about more judicial problems with economic and social upheaval.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Folks, we're back. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. When we took our break, I was talking about how having court systems is a way that we keep things from escalating, and people have to have confidence in the court system. And so if there is some sort of economic collapse, or there's some sort of huge disaster where there's looting and rioting and murders going on and people defending themselves, you know, with deadly force, there's going to have to be a day of reckoning from that. The courts are going to have to get involved. They're going to have to make some judgment calls. People are going to have examples made of them. There are going to be heroes and villains created, and there's going to become a ethos that's created around this event so that we as a society can internalize it and justify it and live with it. And we see that happening with the Old West. I mean, if you look at, like, the stories of Wyatt Earp and Tombstone, what those are is it's an attempt of a national subconscious to deal with crime and lawlessness and the expansion of civilization and the frayed edge of society. But as society is advanced to the West.
You know, that's interesting, too, because the movie Tombstone was always one of my favorites, and I haven't seen it for years. And you just reminded me of that. It's always been just entertaining to me. And now, Doug, I'm going to go home. I have to watch it now. I've got to go watch it with that in mind.
Well, remember that movie is the winner's version. It's the narrative of the common history.
Mm-hmm.
But what really happened there is very different. I mean, if you go and research the history of the event, you know, everyone thinks, Wyatt Earp was, you know, the law, and then we got these lawless cowboys who were doing this and that, and he went to lay down the law, and they didn't. Then there was a shootout, and then there was actually a trial afterwards to see if he was using mm-hmm. excessive force. I mean, there's all this, but was that really it? I mean, do we really know? Because Earp was protecting his own interests in the saloon, mm-hmm. you know, and here there's lots of shades of gray in this whole narrative. But we don't hear that because we have to have something that we can say, well, there was good and there was evil and there was law, there was right and there was wrong, and that's what's important. And I think that we would see the same narrative evolve out of a modern day tragedy that involved the kind of breakdown of lawlessness, that there would have to be good and there would have to be evil, and people who stood up for right and people who were, you know, fomenting the wrong, and the clash between them, and in the end, American good triumphed, and that would be the narrative that would have to come out of it. And who's going to stand by and just let this sort of roll on? In the Old West, we had the marshals, you know. They came in and laid down the law. In a modern uprising, you're going to see the federal government step in.
Right,
and
yeah.
The declaration of martial law.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the big step that everyone isn't really talking about. And what do you do? And we have been preparing, apparently, from all the news stories that I've heard, for some sort of catastrophe to happen. The federal government is buying up millions and millions of rounds of ammunition. The Forestry Service and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are buying machine guns. There's surplus military equipment going to police departments around the country, and these are large, you know, assault vehicles that are heavily armored and designed for a battlefield. And this is being spread out throughout the police departments, throughout the federal government, throughout the country. And there's no reason for it unless they're preparing for some sort of huge catastrophe. And maybe it's wise to prepare for that kind of catastrophe, but the idea is that they're not going to stand idly by while people are being raped and murdered in American streets. They're going to swoop in and be the cavalry and do something about it.
Yes, and I can see where this is necessary, you know, for sure. One of the things I'm curious about, I mean, with martial law, I'm not very familiar with what my rights are under martial law.
Well, actually,
I mean, do I have any rights left?
At this point, nobody's really familiar with what your rights are because we haven't done it.
No.
And, I mean, the last time we had a situation like this was the Civil War. And we've got all of this jurisprudence from then till now changing the way everything works. I mean, our law today is nothing like it was back in the 1850s or in the 1790s. I mean, we are a different country. And how does this play in? I can tell you this, back in World War II, race was a reason to round people up and put them in internment camps. Mm. And that was perfectly legal.
Yeah.
Now, later they decided it wasn't so legal, but there was nothing you can do about it. And that was a famous Supreme Court case called Korematsu. But thousands of people of Japanese descent not even Japanese citizens, people of Japanese descent, were rounded up and put in internment camps for the duration of the war. They lost their businesses, they lost their homes, they lost everything. And they sued, and they were told that they didn't have standing during the war. They couldn't even bring up the lawsuit. During the Civil War, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended. Habeas corpus is Latin for produce the body. Show me the body. Mm-hmm. This is when you are taken into prison. You can say, I want a separate civil judge, someone who is not involved with my case, to make a determination on why I'm sitting here in jail. And that was removed. So there's no way for you to bring up a grievance to say, I should not be incarcerated. And we see that happening over and over throughout our history, that our rights are abrogated. And then it's like, well, yeah, we understand that that shouldn't have been the way it was. But during the time, given the circumstances, we weren't going to look at it. And that's a scary, scary place to be. Gun confiscations in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Here in Georgia, I believe we just passed a law removing the governor's ability to confiscate firearms during a declared state of emergency. Mm-hmm. Before then, every time there was a tornado, the government could, in theory, seize all firearms and legally do so. Now, would that stand up in court? We don't know, because it had never been tried. But what's going to happen is, when you have that kind of emergency, all of these legal provisions, like the executive order that allows the federal government to seize whole bunches of hoarded food goods.
Yeah, I heard that was possible, that was something that was... I had absolutely no idea that if I was putting food back, that they could actually come and take it legally.
There's an executive order that gives them the permission to go and take foodstuffs that are stored up, whether it's in public or in private stores. So, yeah, they could. I mean, I think they're talking about going and raiding Walmart's distribution center for mm-hmm. stuff for the military. But in theory, they could go house to house, you know, quartering soldiers.
So they could do it on a residential.
Yeah, even though level. that's like one of the main reasons we fought the Civil War was quartering soldiers and taking things. Mm-hmm. And there's you know, the Constitution protects that they cannot take your property without just compensation. I mean, all these things are in place, but who knows how it would really pan out? It would be a breakdown, and it would be a new law. And then there would be the lawsuits and everything. But I have a feeling it'd be like Korematsu, where it would sit and all this would happen. And then later they would say, yeah, we shouldn't do that again, but we're not going to revisit it, and you can't do anything about it.
Right. So I kind of feel helpless. Like, I kind of feel like I'm in the edge, sort of just on a wait and see.
And unfortunately, that's kind of where we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way to prepare for everything unless you have unlimited time and unlimited finances.
Yeah, and even if you do have it, there's a you know, possibility it could just be taken away from you anyways.
There is always a possibility that someone's stronger.
But that's no reason not to prepare. That's no reason not to have, you know, some things put away and have a plan. You know, I mean, having a plan is awesome, but, you know, you need a plan A, B, and C.
That's right. And, you know, having all of your stuff in one place is not the wisest solution. Not only from, you know, marauding bandits or marauding governments, but also from fire or predation. You know, you should have stores that are, you know, diversified and kept in different places. You should have a plan for what you're going to do to get from a place that's dangerous to a place that's safe. All of these things come into play. And I hate to leave people with a sour note that, you know, like, oh, government's out to get you, because that's not my message. That's not my message at all. What I'm saying is that in a time of emergency, it's not going to be normalcy. You're not going to have that system that you're accustomed and used to. So you should be prepared for things to not act the way that they normally would. But you're also going to realize that there's going to be consequences, and there's things that are going to happen. And, you know, if you're involved in self-defense shooting in an emergency, it's no different than if you're in self-defense shooting during a normal time.
Right, right.
If you're involved in, you know, if your family's starving and you need, you know, to procure supplies for them, you're going to face consequences for that someday.
Yeah.
It will happen, and justice will have to be served, and it will have to be restored in order for society to move on.
Yeah, and, you know, talking about the legal aspects today of emergency preparedness, it's never really been the forefront on my mind. But once I started thinking about it, I thought, you know, there really are some things I've got to get nailed down and know what my rights are and this kind of thing. Now, people can, if we've had some great information today, and I know that people can contact you through readyradio.net if they have specific questions or if they want to... you know, maybe have you elaborate on something a little bit more. Do you also have like a personal email address or something as well?
I have a private practice. I've been practicing here in Georgia, and I have an office that's in Gordon County. I practice from Gordon and north all the way down to Cobb and around the city here. So if somebody wanted to reach me about a legal problem, they could always email my office at kinglawoffice@gmail.com. There's no S, it's just kinglawoffice@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to address their concerns or see if I could help them with their legal matters.
Yeah, perfect, because you seem like you are very well-versed in everything that we talked about today. I'm glad you're my friend. Well, we only have a few more minutes left. Well, actually, 1 minute left, so let's talk about the product of the week.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I think that this was kind of a surprise topic, but looking at what we've talked about, I know that True Prep has pocket constitutions that they keep next to their register.
Yes.
And I think that that would be an ideal thing for everybody to go and pick up a printed pocket constitution. I know you can get them online and read them for free, but get an actual printed pocket constitution to keep with you at all times and read it and know what it says. Read more than the first sentence. Be better prepared than half your government.
Yes, there you go. Well, thank you guys so much for listening in today. I think we covered some great information. And remember that you can find us on readyradio.net. Don't forget to check out trueprep.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, right? Anything else? Is that it?
Those are all the big three, social media and our website. Check out True Prep. Support our sponsors, everyone. Have a great weekend. This is Doug and Amy on Ready Radio News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by True Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.